let's ask for the Lord's help, and then I'll hand it over. Father in heaven, mighty God, we do thank you for this last time with Dr. Legates, and we pray that you'd help him and help us, and we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you very much. I started on Tuesday by saying it's an honor and a privilege to be here, and I think I was wrong. That's an understatement. I very much appreciated the fellowship, the discussion with people. I've learned some things. Apparently, you can teach an old dog new tricks. Key on the word old and not dog. Cats apparently already know everything, or at least they think they do. So, I also want to apologize up front to Mr. Hodges. I listened to his lecture, and he said, to be a good artist, you embed the actual message much later on, like in Job, instead of putting it in 1 and then 28, you have all that in between. I am not an artist. I'm also not a theologian. I have no idea why that's an inside joke, any event. But I'm a scientist, and we are an impatient group. So I'm going to give you the take-home message now in case I start to run long and I have to shut it off, because the last thing I want to do is get between you and lunch. Here's essentially the take-home message. We are in a spiritual battle. I don't really care what you believe regarding climate change. I've made my case, but you can investigate it yourself, come to your own conclusion. Your salvation does not depend upon what you feel about that policy. But my concern is that why this has taken off and what they are planning to do under the guise of saving the planet from climate change is really what the spirit of the age is all about, or what I would prefer to refer to it here as the spirit of Antichrist. And I want to use the word Antichrist because it is Antichrist. It's opposite to everything Christ says and stands for. If Christ says do something, they refuse to do it. If Christ says do not do something, they will do it in spades. God says to put me first. I'm a jealous God. Have no other gods before me. They, in fact, go so far as to even deny the existence of God. God says, be prosperous. We talked about the wicked equation. We don't want you to be technologically advantaged. We want to keep you technologically disadvantaged. It says, multiply. They want a lower population. Remember the guy from Caltech. It would probably be better if humans had never been invented. They want to stop people from coming out of the womb. And if you do get out of the womb, they want to destroy life as best they can by changing your gender, doing all sorts of other things, and then trying to figure out ways to shorten your life. God says to care for others. They say, no, we want to keep everybody in poverty. Again, the wicked equation. Keep P down, keep affluency down, keep technology down. Christ says, dominate creation. They say, be subservient to your mother nature. And in particular, be subservient to us. As we've talked before about various types of socialism, various types of totalitarian regimes. Let us be in charge of you, not you be subservient only to God. So that is my concern, is that that's where this is all headed. And there's a take-home message. So if you want, you can leave now. But anyway, no. I'll give you some more. But like I say, I'm very much appreciative of all of you. And so therefore, what I want to do is I want to give you a gift. This is currently selling for $250. You can get it out on the boat for the low, low price of free. But they're not going to last long. They're probably going to disappear sometime after lunch. So make sure on the way to lunch you pick up your copy. Don't be caught without one. You know, it's a limited time offer. So back in high school, I read a book, or required to read a book, called The True Believer, Thoughts on the Nature of Mass Movements by Eric Hoffer. Hoffer was a longshoreman. He's not an academic. He's a longshoreman living in the San Francisco Bay Area. And the book was published originally in 1951 after he saw the rise of totalitarian regimes of Franco, Mussolini, Hitler, and so forth. And so his worldview is not something I would take from the book. But there's a couple comments I think that were very useful here. One is that hatred is the most accessible and comprehensive of all the unifying agents. Mass movements can rise and spread without a belief in a God, but never without a belief in a devil. You need something to gel people around that has to be fought, has to be attacked. Maybe there's nothing good, but there has to be something evil that you're going after. And the second quote he has is, the quality of ideas seems to play a minor role in mass movement leadership. What really counts is the arrogant gesture, the complete disregard of the opinion of others, the single-handed defiance of the world. Keep those in mind as we proceed. Now, I'm going to start somewhere where people who know what this is going to say, I never thought I'd hear that come up in this discussion. And it's Pascal's wager. Anybody familiar with it? Okay, a lot of people. Good. Obviously, this is not worldview that we would espouse, but Pascal's wager reads, although the existence of God cannot be determined through reason, a person should wager as though God exists, because living life accordingly has everything to gain and nothing to lose. Graphically, we show it as this way. So along one of the axes, we have either God exists or that God does not exist, and across the top, we have I believe in God and I do not believe in God. And in Pascal's world, his argument is, if God exists and you believe in God, you've gotten the whole thing right, and that takes you to heaven. If God exists but you do not believe in him, then that's a bad thing, and that takes you to whatever he defines as hell. But suppose God does not exist. And remember, in his world, he can't figure out which row we're on. If God doesn't exist, but you act as if there is a higher power, then he argues, well, at least there's moral benefits. And if you don't believe in God and he didn't exist, well, then you wouldn't exist. But if he didn't exist, then the idea is you wouldn't act as if there's a higher power. You'd be correct, but that would lead you to immoral consequences. So Pascal's take-home message is stick to the left. Stay in the green. It doesn't matter whether God exists. It really matters in your belief in God. And so, in this case, the green is good, stay to the left. What Pascal never addresses, of course, is a belief in which God, because there are all sorts of gods to choose from. But in his case, there's no way to know which one's right anyway, so that's why he sort of ignored it and moved on. Now, there's something that comes up in climate discussions, and that is called the precautionary principle. Precautionary principle comes from the Rio Declaration, the Rio meeting in 1992, that we'll talk a bit more about, but it reads as follows. To protect the environment, the precautionary approach shall be widely applied by states or countries according to their capabilities. Where there are threats of serious or irreversible damage, lack of full scientific certainty shall not be used as a reason for postponing cost-effective measures to prevent environmental degradation. And usually in later incarnations of this, the word cost-effective is deleted. We see all the time, there is just simply no time left to argue over climate change. We have to act now. We can't wait for an answer. Now, I started with Pascal's wager, but if you squint a little bit, you'll see that this really actually looks like the precautionary principle, where God is replaced with anthropogenic global warming, and I'm not saying that's God, but essentially, we have a question between either it's significant and affecting the planet, or it's insignificant. And if you go back through the, we can do something about it, or we can do nothing about it. And if you go back through the same arguments we made with Pascal's wager, you can see that if it's a problem and we do something about it, we can solve it, and that takes us to our environmental heaven. If we do nothing about it, it is significant, the Earth bursts into a fireball, and that's the end. But if it's insignificant, if we attempt to do something about it, it's going to have positive environmental benefits. And if we attempt to do nothing about it, we'll have adverse environmental consequences. So for the same reason, let's do something. It doesn't matter whether it's significant or not, because that's always going to put us in the green. And the green is always good, and the red is always bad. Of course, by the same argument, what do we do? There's all sorts of things that we can do. They have all sorts of impacts on the environment, impacts on everybody. Oops, sorry. Impacts on the environment, impacts on everybody. Just like the question of which religion, the question is, what do you want to do? And they never really talk about that. But problem is, it doesn't really look like this. It would be nice if everything were always self-contained, but in fact, the reality is every box has some red and has some green. So it depends on which box you get into, and then once you're in the box, there are still benefits, there are still bad things about being in there, and it's just not as cut and dried as we're told to believe. Now, the precautionary principle has two major components. It requires, first of all, an expression by decision makers to anticipate the harm before it happens. And the second is that it establishes an obligation for action to prevent or minimize such harm if the level of harm gets high. In 2014, there was a hearing in the House, was it the House Committee? This is Representative Kennedy from Massachusetts. He was interviewing Dr. Daniel Botkin, who was testifying. He said to Botkin, "Sir, do you look both ways when you cross the street?" Botkin says, "Yes, sir, I do." And he said, "Well, the reason we do so is our response to climate change must, like looking both ways when we cross the street, follow the precautionary principle." Is that why you cross? You look both ways before you cross the street? Are you following the precautionary principle? I argue you're not. I argue you're actually following something that I refer to as the antithesis to the precautionary principle. You don't act before you know what's going to happen and make sure you just do something because we have to. You do two things. One, it has to affect a positive remedy to the issue at hand. It has to solve the problem. And second, it won't have adverse impacts or create other problems. So I look both ways because, one, it's going to stop me from stepping off the curb if there is a car coming. And two, the time taken that I do by looking both ways is a small cost compared to the big benefit I get. What I don't do is reach into my pocket, pull out my wallet, and take out a $50 bill. Uh-oh, there's none in there. Anyway, take out a $50 bill and toss it into the air. It's doing something. I'm following the precautionary principle. But it's going to have no effect. Why? Number one, it will not affect a positive remedy at hand. It's not going to keep me from being hit by a car. In fact, a car may swerve to try to get the money and run me over anyway. But the second thing is, it will have adverse impacts. Before I can get across town, I'll be broke. So we follow the antithesis of the precautionary principle, not the precautionary principle. But now we're told we have to do the exact opposite of what we normally do. But why are we in this discussion all along? Because isn't the science of climate change settled science? Don't we know everything? We're told time and time again. Here's 2015 in the Washington Post. Yet another survey. Changing tone and so forth. Another survey suggests the climate change debate is settled among scientists. And this is from John Holdren, which again is the Ehrlich Holdren wicked equation. He says, settled enough. It's settled enough. We can proceed. Over time, there have been a lot of people that have tried to figure out what the consensus is. Consensus of consensuses, who says that, is 97% of all scientists. The first one they did was 100%. There's a problem with 100%. All you need to do is find one. Okay, that's done. But the way they do this is they generally take a bunch of articles, and then they look at it and say, does this fit what I think the consensus is? Yes. Does this? Yes. Yeah. And keep doing that with a bunch of articles. And they generally wind up with 97% over here and 3% over here. The question is, where did that number come from? That number is actually predetermined because that 3%, the other side, is actually a number that gets used all the time. For example, here's the 3% rule. When examining organizational processes, typically less than 3% of the total elapsed time is actually needed to complete the process. There's a book on the 3% signal, the investing technique that will change your life. We're also told 3% of the people in your organization do 97% of the work. We're told the 3% rule for insane personal improvement. So the 3% is always referred to, and so it works well. The question is, why don't we just ask scientists? Just take a bunch of scientists and say, what do you think? Tell us. Too obvious, huh? Well, in 2014, the American Meteorological Society did just that. They have meteorologists, climatologists, oceanographers, all sorts of people that are involved in atmospheric science. And they asked them the question, does it say, is global warming happening? And if so, what is its cause? Two-thirds of the people refused to answer. There's a reason. They don't want to be identified as taking a stand. This is a very politically volatile situation. But of those that did, they found out that saying, yes, mostly human, I know you can't see it, that number is 52%. So 52% is a majority. So a majority of scientists said yes, and it's mostly human. 48% said yes, it's mostly natural. Yes, there's insufficient evidence, though, to know. Yes, I don't know. No, I don't care. I don't know, and it's not happening. Well, to say we have the consensus, 52% consensus of scientists, it doesn't hold much. Yeah, well, there's 48%. It's almost 50-50 split. They don't want that. So that's why you never see this again, and I'm not going to do that analysis again. The thing about the scientific method, and you're probably familiar with the scientific method, which a lot of people hate now because we're trying to change it. I'll explain that in a minute. You start with a bunch of observations, and you say, I see some stuff. That leads me to questions. So now I rephrase the question in a testable hypothesis. So what I do is I concoct an experiment to see whether it's true or false. I come to my conclusions, and then I decide from that whether or not my question is appropriately answered, whether I have to change the way I think the world works, proceed on for more questions or whatever. You're probably familiar with the scientific method. We're told, don't use that. This is Forbes magazine. You must not do your own research when it comes to science. And if you start reading the article, they say, research both sides and make up your own mind. It's simple, straightforward, common sense advice. And when it comes to issues like vaccinations, climate change, and the novel coronavirus, it can be dangerous, destructive, even deadly. The techniques that most of us use to navigate most of our decisions in life, gathering information, evaluating it based on what we know, and choosing a course of action can lead to spectacular failures when it comes to science. Really? This is New York Times. Don't go down the rabbit hole. Critical thinking, as we're taught to do it, isn't helping in the fight against misinformation. What's misinformation? Well, that's anybody that disagrees with me. Here's the one I really like. This is from Slate. It's time to give up on facts. You've been listening to facts for too long. Get away from them. They're doing you bad. What should you be doing? Well, it's a more useful weapon. Emotions. How do you feel about it? I mean, this would be funny if they weren't serious. This is ridiculous. So now we're getting what's called post-normal science. And there's post-modern science, which is even worse, but I won't go there. Post-normal science, though, is when facts are uncertain, values are in dispute, stakes are high, and decisions are urgent. It can be framed in terms of a call for the democratization of expertise, and as a reaction against long-term trends of scientization of politics, the tendency towards assigning to experts a critical role in policymaking while marginalizing lay people. Yeah, the experts shouldn't have a big say in what's going on. We should use people that don't know. In the mid-1980s, a demand for policy-oriented climate science arose based on complexity and uncertainty of issues and risks for humanity and ecosystems. This is essentially the diagram. So here we have system uncertainties. Here's where we pretty much know what's going on. Here's where we have no clue. This is the decision stakes. Are we in something that is meaningless? Are we in something that makes all the difference in the world? The argument is that climate change is way out here. So if we're using the old scientific method, it's only applicable down in here, when everything is certain, when the stakes are low. When we get out here, we need something new. And that's where we have post-normal science. What is post-normal science? It says, post-normal science, normal science depends on experts. Post-normal science relies on peers with diverse backgrounds, experience, and expertise. Normal science depends on explicit facts. Post-normal science uses extended facts, supplemented with tacit knowledge based on your experiences and, of course, feelings. Normal science stays within paradigms. Post-normal science blurs boundary between paradigms and allows multiple people to participate regardless of background. And normal science is simple puzzle solving, whereas post-normal science addresses complex and multi-causal problems that may be intractable and without a simple answer. How did we get here? Some of you may have heard the phrase groupthink. That was from Irving Janis, and he said, consensus decision-making was touted as integral to healthy democratic culture, but consensus can't be a bad thing, can it? Well, in this case, the idea is it's a groupthink is a psychological phenomenon in which people strive for consensus within a group. But the effort to create a consensus can force dissenting views to be silenced, particularly when the situation is very stressful and when stakes are potentially high. Read climate change. Janis analyzed what happens when people get caught up in groupthink, which is a pattern of collective psychological behavior with three distinctive features that we can characterize as rules. They are: a group of people come to share a particular view or belief without a proper appraisal of the evidence. This leads them to insist that their belief is shared by a consensus of all right-minded opinion. And because their belief is ultimately subjective, they then defend it only by displaying an irrational, dismissive hostility towards anyone daring to question it. I go back to Eric Hoffer's quote, it fits it to a T. 1951, Janis didn't come about until 20-some years later. So with the demise of global cooling in the late 70s, replaced by global warming in the 90s, carbon dioxide became the evil gas, and it would threaten our very existence. Since then, the central aim of climate change has been to decarbonize the world's economy. Their goal was to eliminate the use of fossil fuels, on which mankind's material progress has been based for at least 200 years, and to rely instead on carbon-free sources of energy, most notably wind and solar. I know there's a question coming up regarding the phrase fossil fuels. We tend to use that because early geologists thought the only way they could be produced was by fossils and dead and decaying material. That might not be the case, but we still use the terminology because it stuck. Such efforts, as argued by alarmists, will bring about a reduction in human emissions of carbon dioxide sufficient to have a significant influence on the Earth's climate. Consequently, the global warming narrative is poised to fundamentally transform our civilization by undermining the energy sources that have led to our modern industrial society. But why? For years, socialism has focused on the collective over the individual. We've talked about this before, emphasizing the greater good over the needs and wants of a single person. This requires everyone to be equal, but not just equal in opportunity, to be equal in outcome, whereas the word is now defined equity. In the socialist view, the struggle lies between the haves and the have-nots, those who have acquired what they have by exploiting those who have not. This posits a class struggle, I should say, which socialism seeks to eliminate through a guarantee of equality of outcomes, or equity. Thus, socialism requires two things. It requires an agent and a mechanism to punish the haves by taking away what they have and giving it to those who have not, so much like the story of Robin Hood, who robbed from the rich and then gave it to the poor. But how can equity be enacted on a global scale? Clearly, there are countries who have and those who have not, and unlike the traditional Marxist state that invokes equity among individuals, it's not really possible to engineer a society where equality of outcomes can be legislated across country boundaries. So we need a solution to punish the rich countries and give to the poor countries. And that's where effectively the United Nations comes in. It was designed as a forum for nations to communicate, which was useful. There's a lot of useful things it can do. It can organize people to go against rogue nations, to go against dictators that are trying to do bad things in certain parts of the country. It's good to have a forum for discussion. But the United Nations can also become the agent to create social change among nations by becoming the modern-day Robin Hood. The UN could demand money from rich nations and then give it to poor nations and spend it on itself. That is, provide global wealth redistribution. In addition to an agent for the change, socialists also need a mechanism to justify actions and to get nations to join in with them. Climate change becomes that issue. Nations have become rich because they've become industrialized. Activists argue that industrialization has led to the use of fossil fuels, which in turn are destroying our climate. Rich nations, therefore, must pay for their transgressions by giving much of their wealth to the poor nations. This is the reason why climate change has become the cause célèbre of the United Nations. In parallel with socialism, the nature of climate change politics is that the poor are those most disaffected by the impact of global warming. You hear that all the time. To allow poor countries to become industrialized, which is how the wealthy nations overcame poverty, the alarmists argue, is to hurt them even more. For them, to become like developed nations is like the book Catch-22, and that that they must adopt self-harming policies as well as policies that in turn harm other nations. Thus, alarmists usually demand that undeveloped countries must remain undeveloped to ensure that they are somehow protected from the evils of climate change. Alarmists believe underdeveloped and undeveloped nations must be kept as they've existed for centuries, at one with nature and living within the noble native concept. Of course, such policies are not at one with nature, and environmental degradation and childhood mortality plague these societies. Only after such pressing needs as food, clothing, shelter, and safety have been met can environmental issues rise to the level of being important enough to consider. The mechanisms by which the United Nations uses climate change as a vehicle to enact social change are through the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. If you haven't heard any of those, I don't know where you've been because it's all over the place, but hopefully now you have. The question is, how did they come to be? The history of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change actually begins in obscurity back in the late 1970s. After about three decades of declining air temperatures and global cooling, the late 1970s saw a resumption in the rise of air temperature that had been observed as far back as the mid-1800s. Despite the global cooling of the early 1970s, several scientists have become convinced that increasing atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations must necessarily lead to a warming of the planet. Leading this group was Swedish scientist Bert Bolin, who had noted that the cooling since the 1940s had ended and had been replaced by modest warming. In 1979, Bolin attended the world's first climate conference, organized by the World Meteorological Organization of the United Nations. His arguments were very persuasive, particularly to members of the conference organizing committee. Future conferences were scheduled to further discuss the possibility of global warming, and the World Climate Program of the United Nations was subsequently founded. Subsequent workshops were held in Villach, Austria in 1980, 1983, and 1985. At the third Villach workshop, Bolin argued that anthropogenic increases in greenhouse gases called for immediate action, and the conference attendees were summarily impressed. The paper was well received by the Deputy Executive Director of the UN Environment Program, Dr. Mustafa Tolba. Tolba was an Egyptian plant pathologist who had previously served as the president of the Egyptian Olympic Committee. What's he have to do with climate? Oh, well. A consensus then was reached by an international group of scientists that the first half of the next century, a rise of global mean temperature would occur, which is greater than any in man's history. We haven't looked at the data yet, but we know what's going to happen. It was subsequently recommended that scientists and policymakers should work together to examine policies that would effectively address the problem. Sir John Houghton, then head of the United Kingdom Meteorological Office and former professor at Oxford, was significantly impressed with Bolin's arguments and joined him as Bolin's most influential ally. Following the third Villach workshop, global warming had become a major topic of discussion, both in the media and with respect to international policymaking. I particularly like this quote, "The impacts of global warming are such that I have no hesitation describing it as a weapon of mass destruction." And we haven't looked at the data yet either. Four important players were needed and were responsible for elevating global warming to this status. Two were part of the United Nations Environment Program, World Meteorological Organization. One was a non-governmental organization called the International Council for Science. It subsequently changed its name and essentially dropped out of the discussion. But the one that's the most important is the one over here. It's got the most fossil fuel companies associated with it. It's got the biggest budget that it gives to the United Nations. And in particular, had the biggest carbon footprint. And of course, That's the United States. The problem is, they needed a political ally inside the UN to get this to work. And that person is Maurice Strong. He was a Canadian businessman with ties to oil fields in Alberta. He's a self-professed socialist in ideology, but capitalist in methodology. And he long believed that the United Nations must be transformed into a world government. Never heard that before, have you? After leading the World Conference on the Environment, Strong was appointed the first head of the United Nations Environment Program, where he organized expert meetings on climate change. Back in 1992, he gave an interview, and he was talking about a book he intended to write. He never wrote the book, but many people argue he attempted to play it out in real life. Here's the outline of the book, he said. What if a small group of world leaders were to conclude that the principal risk to the Earth comes from the actions of rich countries? And if the world is to survive, those rich countries would have to sign an agreement reducing their impact on the environment. So to save the planet, the group decides, isn't the only hope for the planet that the industrialized civilizations collapse? Isn't it our responsibility to bring that about? So this group of world leaders forms a secret society to bring about an economic collapse. It's scary, isn't it, that somebody actually in power and ability is thinking this way? He also made a lot of other fun, disturbing comments. Current lifestyles and consumption patterns of the affluent middle class, including high meat intake, the use of fossil fuels, electrical appliances, home and workplace air conditioning, and suburban housing are not sustainable. And our concepts of ballot box democracy may need to be modified to produce strong governments capable of making difficult decisions. Strong had been connected to the United Nations since 1970. He had come to use the United Nations' prestige to promote a sweeping socialist agenda. He argued that the natural resources of the earth were the common inheritance of all mankind, tragedy of the commons, and that the rich Western countries, which had benefited so disproportionately from supporting them, must now be made to fund the poorer countries and the rest of the world to help their economies, and of course, the United Nations. In 1987, Strong and the United Nations Environment Program were able to push their agenda further as members of the Brundtland Commission. Their report introduced the concept of sustainable development and described how sustainable development could be achieved. Chaired by Norwegian Prime Minister Gro Harlem Brundtland, the report laid particular emphasis on the dangers of, quote, human-induced climate change, warning that this could raise global temperatures to such a level that would have serious effects on agriculture, raise sea levels, flood coastal cities, and disrupt national economies. The report called for major global efforts to curb emissions on carbon dioxide and all other greenhouse gases. Strong had played a key behind-the-scenes role in organizing the conference in Canada that produced the Montreal Protocol, which you probably know was what phased out chlorofluorocarbons to save the ozone layer. This process enabled him to see that in global warming, he had found an even more powerful theme on which to push his longtime political agenda. And in 1988, everything came together. On a hot, humid day in June of 1988, Senator Tim Worth of Colorado chaired a hearing on the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources. Six experts testified. There's only one you'll ever remember. He was Jim Hansen, who was at the time was head or the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York City. He is famous for saying, "We are 99% certain that humans are changing the Earth's climate." The media were told this hearing would result in something earth-shattering, so they turned out in force. Hansen's wildly alarmist predictions that the world was heading for a global Armageddon made lurid headlines across the United States and beyond, including cover stories in Time and Newsweek. In November of 1988, just 5 months later, the inaugural meeting of a new body, sponsored by the WMO and the UNEP, was held, and they called it the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Although it was sold as an impartial body of world scientists, the IPCC was never intended by those who established it to be anything of the kind. Bolin was its first chairman. Houghton was chosen to chair the all-important section on the science of climate change when the IPCC came to compile its first report. Not only were both men totally committed to the belief in human-induced climate change, so were everyone around the table at the first meeting, which represented 34 nations. Within just 2 years, it was proposed, the IPCC would present its first assessment report, in which the key ingredient would be computer models programmed to determine the extent to which rising levels of carbon dioxide would warm the world. As promised, the first assessment was published in 1990. Climate trends were portrayed as portending dire conditions because of anthropogenic warming. The first assessment used climate models to argue that 21st century warming would be just less than 1 degree Fahrenheit per decade, as much as 8 times the calculated decadal rate for the entire 20th century. By the way, since then, it's been nowhere near that. But we didn't need truth, did we? When the first assessment report appeared in 1990, the global headlines were led by a claim in the summary for policymakers that the IPCC was confident the increase in carbon dioxide alone had been responsible for more than half of the world's warming. Problem. When I said summary for policymakers, did you think it was sort of like the Cliff Notes? No. In fact, the summary was written by Houghton himself. It had nothing to do with the science document. And that was one of the problems. A lot of people said, wait a minute. We need to have more people involved than just one person's view of what they think the whole thing looks like. So they changed the method. So in the future, going forward, every nation, they will produce this, and every nation shall sit down, and we will go line by line, and they will up or down every line. So if every nation says up, it stays in. If any nation says nope, it gets kicked out. That's how we're going to do it in the future, but we're stuck with this one. The interesting thing is Houghton made sure that despite the caveats, concerns, and contradictions raised in the actual text, the summary put an alarmist spin on the results, and climate change was what it would become later, the existential threat to the planet. Following the release of the report and its impact in 1990, Strong organized an Earth Summit in 92 in Rio de Janeiro, the Rio Summit. It became the largest conference ever held. It was attended by 108 world leaders, all the way from Cuba's Fidel Castro to U.S. President George Herbert Walker Bush. There were 20,000 other delegates, and also present were 20,000 other climate activists and members of green lobby groups, all paid by the UN and funded through funds from the United States. Strong masterminded every detail of this extraordinary gathering, which led to establishment of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. In 1995, every 5 years, we're going to update the report. So in 1995, the second one was supposed to come out, and indeed it did. So, as I said, we've changed the way we do the rules. So the summary for policymakers, so a bunch of people are going to write it, and then all the countries of the world decide up or down for every sentence, and there we have our document. So the document is approved, it goes out, and all of a sudden, it doesn't match what they approved. There are phrases in there such as, the balance of evidence suggests that there is a discernible human influence on the global climate. I never approved that. And there were stuff that were missing. Like, for example, none of the studies cited above has shown clear evidence that we can attribute the observed changes to the specific cause of increases in greenhouse gas. So what happened? It was later confirmed that a group of scientists led by Ben Sanner of the Lawrence Livermore National Lab had gone into a separate room to make changes. What came to light 2 years later was the sequence of events that preceded the change. In fact, before the scientists had signed off on the text and before the nations had, after the nations had completed it, Houghton, as the report's editor, received an urgent communique from the State Department in Washington, D.C. That communique read, "It is essential that the chapters not be finalized prior to the completion of the discussions at the IPCC Working Group 1 plenary in Madrid, and that chapter authors be prevailed upon to modify their text in an appropriate manner following the discussion in Madrid." Stop. Who authorized this from the United States? It actually turned out it came from U.S. Undersecretary of State for Global Affairs, Tim Wirth. Remember, he was the guy who set this whole thing up to begin with in 1988 with Jim Hansen. And I didn't tell you the full story, but that was very much stagecraft because what they did the night before, they literally went in and turned off the air conditioning. It's a hot day in June. So when everybody shows up for the meeting, The room is like 90 degrees. There's high humidity because it's in a swamp in D.C. And, wow, he's up there doing this the whole time, which makes for beautiful stagecraft. At the upcoming Global Climate Conference in Kyoto in 97, remember, 2 years after each one, they have a big meeting. Wirth and others plan to realize Strong's long-term agenda, which included much socialism, obviously. The Kyoto Protocol, you may have heard of, is what it would be called, would commit the Western nations to reducing their carbon dioxide emissions since they were the oppressors and pay exorbitant sums of money to still developing nations, the oppressed, including China and India. China and India had become by then some of the biggest users of carbon dioxide producing fuels. Nevertheless, they were exempt from the discussion. This provides funds to developing nations, to the UN, to non-governmental organizations, while putting the brakes on the economies of the West. What actually happened was this one-sided deal put Vice President Al Gore on the spot. The Senate had already voted on this deal, and they voted 95-0 that we could not accept it. Now think about that for a moment. 95-0. So there's 100 senators, so five of them were not voting. But of the 95 that were, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, they're all on board. When have you ever seen that happen? No dissent at all. This is bad policy. So they said, we can't accept it. Nevertheless, you see Al Gore signing it. There was lots of applause. It was completely meaningless because we'd already rejected the thing. Third assessment report was released in 2001. It's actually, we were supposed to do every 5 years. This is 6 years. Okay, so it's a year behind. The problem was more than anything that worried the IPCC was this long view that during the Middle Ages, the so-called medieval warm period, the world had been even hotter than it had been in the 20th century. See, this is the fundamental problem. As Overpeck said, look, I keep running into people that say, if it's carbon dioxide, what on earth was going on here? Because you're telling me carbon dioxide went like this and then shot upward. Okay, I get it. It's causing that rise. But how did it rise here? And as a result, how do you know that rise is carbon dioxide induced? His conclusion? We've got to do more science. No, that's not his conclusion. His conclusion, we got to get rid of the medieval warm period. Make it go away. And that's exactly what happened. 4 years later, as if on cue, a graph appears in the journal Nature, which was now called the hockey stick, because if you squint, it looks sort of like a hockey stick. The graph shows temperatures steadily declining over the past millennium until suddenly in the 20th century, bang, they shoot upwards. Here's human impact from industrialization. There's lots of variability, but the trend is slightly downward. See, we were headed into global cooling. We stopped that, and unfortunately now we're setting fire to the planet. We got to stop that too. But you'll notice, the medieval warm period is gone. And now we don't have to explain it away anymore because magically it poofed, gone. Medieval warm period, as I said, 4 centuries-long ice age had completely disappeared. There's one problem with it. It was championed by its creator, a young scientist with limited experience called Michael Mann. Mann subsequently was selected to head the important chapter that focused on air temperature reconstructions, which explains why the hockey stick got into the third assessment report. So with the hockey stick, Mann and his two colleagues had rewritten history. But there's something you don't see. One of the neat things about this is they argued that 1998 was the warmest year of the last millennium, and the 1990s were the warmest of the last decade. So he actually drafted it many different times, publishing it in different places. And so they came out at different times. So this one came out in early 2002, and you can see in particular how you have warming taking place. The problem is, statistically, they said, wait a minute, you're using one standard deviation as an uncertainty. You should be using two. So you need to increase that. So he increased it. And then later on, there were some problems, so the uncertainty got bigger, and then the uncertainty finally shows up in the entire record like this. So what did he do? Well, back here, the problem is the warming is 0.3 degrees Celsius. But remember, you've got to use two standard deviations. So over here, we just simply move that upwards. Now I can still say that 1998 is the warmest year and the 1990s are the warmest decade. Well, with more changes, up, can't say that anymore, so we'll move it up a little bit more to almost 0.6. And by the time it appears in the IPCC report, it's now up here almost to 0.7. I don't need to tell you, this isn't how you do science. But it's how you do propaganda. And that's one of my other concerns, is this stuff is loaded with propaganda. We found this out, got us in trouble, of course, because how dare you criticize the emperor by saying he has no clothes. But nevertheless, this is what happened. Well, since then, we've had the fourth assessment report, the fifth assessment report, the sixth assessment report. Have to do it together because the fourth assessment report would have been FAR, which is what we called the first assessment report. So now it's assessment report 4, 5, and 6. And each time, the world is always getting worse. Global warming is more draconian than the one before, and what we need to do is more dramatic than that happened. We've had had other meetings. Rio, Kyoto, Paris in 2015, you may remember. These are major meetings where big changes are made. And so as a result, we've had now, since in 2019, we've had 49 sessions of the IPCC. What effect has that had on global carbon dioxide? So here's our carbon dioxide curve. Here are all of the meetings in which we are demanding money and getting money and demanding sanctions and getting sanctions, and it has no effect whatsoever on carbon dioxide trends. Why not? This isn't about carbon dioxide. It's about something else entirely. So let's go back to the meeting in IPCC in Paris, France, in 2015. There's one person on stage who deserves special attention. Her name is Cristiana Figueres. She's Executive Secretary of the UN's Framework Convention on Climate Change. Her father was a 3-time president of Costa Rica. She has degrees in anthropology. She admitted before the Paris conference that, quote, "This is the first time in the history of mankind we are setting ourselves the task of intentionally, within a defined period of time, changing the economic development model that has been reigning for at least 150 years since the Industrial Revolution. That will not happen overnight, and it will not happen at a single conference on climate change." You thought that conference was supposed to be climate change. It's not. It's changing the economic development model of the world. A year earlier, she actually revealed that America's two-party constitutional system was hampering the UN's global objectives. You've heard that before. And so she cited China's communist system as the kind of government America must adopt if the United Nations can do what it needs. In other words, she believes the United States must be transformed into a communist, one-party nation so that the United Nations can accomplish its goals. She came in 2015. Before her was Dr. Rajendra Pachauri. He was in from 2002 to 2015, and until he was forced to leave on sexual misconduct allegations. He quoted during his Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech as saying, "We have embarked globally on a path of unsustainable development. Our lifestyles, the way we produce goods and services, are all part of a system that is completely unsustainable. I see solutions to climate change leading to a much larger philosophical shift in the way human society develops. We need a new matrix to define what human progress is." And then he said, "For me, the protection of planet Earth, the survival of all species, and the sustainability of our ecosystems is more than a mission. It's my religion and my dharma." Here is Dr. Otmar Edenhofer. He's chair of Working Group 3. Working Group 3 is the mitigation chapter, or mitigation group. So the idea is he is supposed to be figuring out how we stop carbon dioxide from getting into the atmosphere. So he's going to tell us about that, right? Now, he says, "One must say clearly that we redistribute de facto the world's wealth by climate policy. Obviously, the owners of coal and oil will not be enthusiastic. One has to free oneself from the illusion that international climate policy is environmental policy. This has almost nothing to do with environmental policy anymore. The next World Climate Summit in Cancun, which was 2015, is actually an economy summit during which redistribution of the world's resources will be negotiated. Okay, we've got about 10 minutes. You've probably seen this quote before. This is the former chief of staff to Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I'm not going to attempt to pronounce his name, but he said the interesting thing about the Green New Deal, it wasn't originally a climate thing at all, because we really think of it as a how do you change the economy thing. This is David Brower, founder of the Sierra Club. Sierra Club's mission statement is to explore, enjoy, and protect wild places of the earth, to practice and promote responsible use of the earth's ecosystems and resources, to educate and enlist humanity to protect and restore the quality of natural and human environments. Sounds like that could be a good Christian organization. The goal now is a socialist redistributionist society. Back to John Holdren. Remember, he was White House Office of Science and Technology Policy from 2009 to 2017. That's 8 years in which he is leading the nation's Office of Science and Technology Policy. He said, a massive campaign must be launched to de-develop the United States. Remember, that wicked equation is his. We've got to get rid of T. I equals P-A-T. T is technology. Got to get rid of technology. He's in charge of technology, and his goal is to reduce it, and that's exactly what he says he's going to do. It says, the ideology of global warming has much in common with other examples of good groupthink. It originated with only a very small group of people who had become gripped by a visionary idea. It was based on predictions of a hypothetical future, which could not be definitively proved right or wrong. For many, climate change is the mechanism by which the socialist dream of wealth redistribution and a global socialist economy can be realized. The discussion about climate change now opens up all sorts of discussions of the radical socialists. Population control, including abortion, birth control, euthanasia, are fundamental results of saving the planet from the ravages of climate change. I'll give you one last quote. This is from in 2017 from Antonio Guterres, who was Secretary General of the United Nations. He was Prime Minister of Portugal, and he's a member of the Portuguese Socialist Party. The Washington Times wrote, more specifically, Guterres wants social media executives to take the censorship against conservatives, against free thinkers, against Christians, against individualists to a whole new level. He sees free speech as an impediment to the implementation of our common agenda, which is a sort of roadmap to total top-down global controls on the citizens of the world using fear. Fear of pandemics, fear of climate change, fear of inequality, and fear of discrimination as the primary fuel. He wants the United Nations to control financial institutions. He wants the United Nations to take charge of educating young people. He wants the United Nations to be the decider of human rights. He wants the United Nations to be the determiner of proper speech. Non-governmental organizations such as the Natural Resources Defense Council and the World Resources Institute are all behind the need for governmental intervention and to affect our economy to accomplish their goals. The Great Reset, which you may have heard, involves drastically increasing the power of government through expansive new social programs like the Green New Deal and using vast regulatory schemes and government programs to coerce corporations into supporting socialist causes. Proponents argue that the four horsemen of the apocalypse, climate change, loss of biodiversity, overpopulation, and a consumer economy require us to change to a government-controlled society. Currently, climate change legislation has the biggest traction. The Great Reset has already been backed by influential leaders, activists, academics, and institutions. In addition to the World Economic Forum and the United Nations, the Great Reset movement counts among its supporters the International Monetary Fund, heads of state, Greenpeace, CEOs, presidents of large corporations, and financial institutions. I think we already talked about that last night with Pastor Myers. As Jean-Francois Lyotard wrote, everyone and everything is purchased not to find truth, but to augment power. This is exactly what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change is all about. It's not about climate. It's about power and control, and the ruse about saving the planet is simply the means to achieve that end. So let me give you a verse from Ephesians. Finally, be strong in the Lord and the strength of his might. Put on the full armor of God so that you will be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. We heard last night from Pastor Myers, and we've heard from virtually everybody else, we are in a spiritual battle. This is not a discussion over climate change. This is a discussion over changing everything. As Pastor Myers just said this morning, we need godly men and women to fight for the cause of Christ. The advantage is we fight for the most important, the biggest, the only, most powerful God of the universe. He's the only God that exists. Everything else is a pretender. He is omniscient. He is omniscient. Sorry, omniscient. He's all-powerful. Let me do it right. He is all-powerful. He is all-knowing. He is all-present. Okay? He is the creator of the universe, created everything we saw simply with one word, his word. And he sustained it all simply with his being. Anything apart from him will cease to exist. So hopefully get yourself on the right side if you aren't. If you are, I'm glad to be with you. But he hasn't sent us out alone. We have the full armor of God. And not all of that armor is defensive. There's the sword of the Spirit in particular, which is an offensive weapon. It's the word of God. As I said, it created everything. It is an offensive weapon. We need to fight back. As Pastor Myers said, don't give up the fight. Don't run away from it. We cannot afford to simply be standing on the sidelines. We cannot afford to be in the stands. We are commanded to get out on the battlefield, get dressed, and to get active. So, are you going to be, are you going to join in the fight with us for Christ? I didn't hear you. Are you going to join the fight with Christ?
Yes.
Then let's get dressed and let's go. Thanks. Thank you.